Welcome to another episode of the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you with me as we do this one more time. Thanks so much for the response I've gotten over the last few shows. People are still sending me emails and Facebook messages about the Charlie Daniels tribute. I was an honor to do it. And the conversation with John Barry and Heidi Newfield and Kent Blasey and J.P. Pennington and all the rest that were on there, it was just... was great. And I got a chance to play disc jockey a little bit and use some music in there. You know, I've always wanted to do a show on Sundays somewhere, just for an hour, called Sunday Songs. I do an event weekly on my Facebook page called Sacred Sunday Songs. I've been doing this 10 years, like 580 Sundays in a row. I never missed it. And the whole concept is to take music and use it as a way to push back on the erosion of life, which is, you know, constant. And when I was on the air doing regular traditional terrestrial radio, I'd often use music in my shows and things like that to underscore the message or the conversation or the theme. But I've always would love to do just a Sunday show, kind of old timey, you know, you get to talk a little bit, play some music. And I always fascinated with the stories behind the music, like they did on VH1 for a time, behind the music. And I just find it fascinating, some of the songs that people write, what they do, how it comes about, all fascinating to me. So thanks for that. Was happy to do it. Devil went down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind. He was way behind because he was willing to make a deal. That's a great line, one of the all-time great lines in music. Anyway, I appreciate all the feedback. Let's get on to today's show, Up the Down Staircase in the Outdoor, Find Sense in the Senseless, and Let's Find Some Obvious Buried in the Absurd. You might hear a little ambiance noise behind me today. I'm not really sure. I have all the windows open in the vaunted Life 2.0 studios, which is also my office, full disclosure. And I got all these windows in here, and I don't like air conditioning per se. I mean, if it's 9,000 degrees, then I'm cranking up the air in here. But for the most part, I would rather just have, you know, air that I can breathe, even though I'm very, very thankful to Mr. Carrier, who came up with the first air conditioner. And I remember a time when air conditioning was sold as like an add-on. You know, you can go to the movies and it was air conditioned, or go to a motel that had air conditioning. So it has its place and time just for this kit. It's not all the time and not all over the place. So you might hear a little bit of ambience in the back, and that's okay. We'll just go with it. Today is a different deal for me in some respects, not so much, but most of the shows that you hear have me either in conversation with somebody, an author, someone of name and note, the famous and the infamous, the newsbreakers, the groundbreakers, the risk takers, and the rule breakers. I love conversation with people who are actually out doing things, because it's too easy just to live back on rhetoric. And I had an incident this past week that was a little interesting to me. It shouldn't have been surprising, but it was. The podcast that is after Charlie Daniels that was aired last Saturday was about the Redskins logo in Washington. And again, I spend about an hour doing the show, another hour, hour and a half, whatever, cleaning it up, putting it together, what have you. And I posted that on my Facebook page, which is one of the places that I, you know, kind of promote what I do. And, you know, people listen or whatever. I mean, it's part of the whole unsocial media deal that you got to put out there in the world. I don't do much Twitter because I forget all the time. Whatever. So, but that one I did put on Twitter. And before I could even get the post dried, the ink on the post dried on Facebook, people were at each other's throats big time. And it was disappointing to me, because the one line out of everything we talked about, Joe Podlesic and I talked about last week with that logo thing, was that communicating with each other is the bridge to understanding. When we don't communicate and you just throw up on each other, there's no understanding, there's no change, there's nothing happens from that, except you got to keep wiping yourself off. So literally, I had just put the post up, put a little description, the same one that's on the page for Life 2.0, basically, and people were going at it. They hadn't even listened to the podcast, and they're beating the snot out of each other verbally. And I just found that highly distressing on some level. And these are all people that I know to some degree, lesser or greater. And I just watched this. It was like literally Pavlov's dog ringing the bell, and out they come. And all it said was, the first one was, you know, I don't agree with the logo being changed. And it was off to the races. It was Trump's fault. It was Obama's fault. It's probably my fault, Joe Podlesnik's fault, the guy who created the logo's fault, Dan Snyder's fault. It was this onslaught of the lowest of human behavior. That is not unusual. It's been going on since there are more than three of us on the planet. But it's unusual on my page because that's my sandbox. And I always tell people, don't shit in my sandbox. Because then I got to clean it up. And if you keep doing it, you don't belong there. And I think part of it is once upon a time, you would hear these comments here or there, you know, but you would leave. There wasn't this 24/7 instantaneous response to stuff. Back in the day, something would happen or you'd have a conversation with somebody at a bar and you'd leave it there or some other place, picnic, backyard, whatever. That was the end of it. It ain't the end of it anymore. Now it's because it gets piled on. And 5 days later, people are still making comments on stuff that's already gone. So I actually dumped that post on Facebook. First, I gave a warning before I dumped it, actually. I said, if you keep doing this, you know, you're going to have to go to your rooms and I'm cutting you off. And it continued. And it was just another indicator to me of how far down the drain, technically especially, that we are. We have instantaneous contact with people we don't even know. And you can throw up and walk out the door. And then I got to clean it up or somebody else has to. And I'm not having it. You know, there's an old saying about the black wolf and the white wolf in the Native American traditions. And the story goes, I'm just paraphrasing here, that this young boy goes to his grandfather and says, Grandfather, last night I had a dream. There were these two wolves fighting. One was a black wolf, one was a white wolf. And it scared me. And what did that mean? And the old man, who'd been around for a very long time, said, well, those two wolves live both inside all of us. And the black wolf is all the things that are the lower part of humanity. Envy, negativity, anger, shame, pain, guilt, you name it. That's all in the black wolf. And the white wolf is the opposite. It's hope and it's peace and it's understanding, it's forgiveness and it's love. And they fight all the time. And the one that wins is the one you feed the most. And if you take a look around the world today, it's not hard to see that black wolf gets fed on an ongoing basis, minute by minute, if not second by second. And we forget the white wolf, and it gets more and more difficult to make our way through the world, which is difficult enough already. And I think that the hard part is it's a true loss of perspective. And we have in our mind this, you know, version of Mayberry somewhere or some other kind of idyllic community that we had this stretch where nothing was going wrong. You can't go to one decade in our history and find out that we weren't doing something, wasn't going down the shitter. But we don't look at those things. We think today, the world's ending. What happened to morality? Have you read a history book? Is what I'm saying. So my point was, in all of that little bit of a rant, that I saw it mostly as an experiment, and it worked. Meaning, it doesn't take much for people to do a knee-jerk reaction and to turn everybody into jerks. It doesn't take much. It doesn't take anything except a concept or a thought. And so to agree to disagree is a strength these days. I don't have to agree with people. My friend John Barry, I think he said it in the Charlie Daniels tribute. He said, all we're supposed to do is love each other. Don't have to like each other. Don't have to even agree with each other. But if you come from that place where the white wolf is, it's difficult, but it's doable. Because otherwise, this stuff just doesn't end. And you know, I don't know that it's supposed to. Meaning that hope, the concept of hope, comes out of the clash between the two, where you're going to position yourself. Interestingly enough to me, out of the people that were beating the snot out of each other on my Facebook page, only one of them apologized to me. The other two, three, four, I don't even know if they were aware what they're doing. It's like a lot of things in life with people. You know, what stuff comes out of some people's mouth, it's not so much what they say, but how they say it. Sometimes it's both, but they were on to the next thing. No idea what was going on, didn't care. Bang, 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 blah, 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 throwing up on each other. It's like monkeys throwing shit out the bars at people, right? And we're going to keep throwing shit at each other until we run out of shit to throw. And then we'll just have to create some more. The one tenet that I have in this show, in everything I've ever done in radio, it's the only reason I even think that I'm supposed to be doing this, is to find a way to build some bridges. Everybody's tried it. I'm not the first. I'm sure I'm not going to be the last. But I'd rather build bridges than dig ditches. That's easy. Building bridges isn't so easy. And so whether people agree or disagree with politics or what have you, I don't care about that. As I always say, and I was talking to the one person who did a call and apologized to me, I've never seen Democrat, Republican, liberal, independent, conservative on a headstone in my whole life. And I know I say that all the time, but so what, now what? Never. ever, ever, ever. So if it's not that important to be etched in stone when you're done, when your time's up, when the meter ran out, why do we make it such a divisive factor today when it could be very, very different? That's the challenge. And that's what I've always done. These shows, whether people get that or not, are really, that's underneath all of it, is how do we build bridges? Ditches are easy. You want to keep digging a ditch or gulch and keep people farther in front. That's easy. It's not easy as crossing over that and building a bridge over those ditches and saying, come on, we can meet in the middle. And as Charlie Daniels even said, the quote that I put in last week, you may not agree with my politics or my expression of faith, but I know that there's 12 notes in a song somewhere we can agree on, and he's right. So how do we find the 12 notes in our lives and get off that other bullshit? That is the question. Anyway, enough of that. How much time did I waste there? Maybe it wasn't too bad. Anyway, what I wanted to get to today, and I am, is something that happened 105 years ago. It's a history lesson in some respects. It's also one of the most odd, strangest, unexplained experiences of my entire life. My book Phenomenon came out this year, and it is filled with things that and the subtitle of the book is Sacred Moments, Messages, Memories, and Other Shit That I Can't Explain, because I can't, and I don't think that I'll ever will. So it leaves me with this incredible sense of wonder going, what else is going on that I don't know about that's not in the headlines on CNN, Fox, or MSNBC, or fill in the blank? There's nothing there for me. When you're around long enough, you've seen this all before. And you forgot, because here we are now with Pavlov's bell ringing over and over again. We start drooling like dogs again. So anyway, when I was putting the book together, I had to include this chapter that was so, in many ways, unnerving to me and still is, that I thought today, on the 105th anniversary of that Eastland disaster, I would share it. This is directly from the book Phenomenon. As you know, I don't like scripted stuff, but I'm going to read it just as I wrote it. This chapter is called Etched in Stone, and every word of it is true. At 6:30 in the morning on July 24th, 1915, in spite of the steady rain, the massive crowd had gathered and was beginning to board the SS Eastland that was docked at the Clark Street Bridge on the Chicago River between Clark and LaSalle Street. It was, by all accounts, a most anticipated event for thousands of employees of the Western Electric Hawthorne Works plant based in Cicero, Illinois. They would be embarking on a boat trip across Lake Michigan to the 5th annual company picnic in Michigan City, Indiana. This was a big deal to most of the employees, many of whom could never imagine taking a holiday free and paid for, such as this one. The Eastland was known as the Speed Queen of the Great Lakes, and it was one of five excursion boats, along with the Theodore Roosevelt, the Petoskey, Racine, and the Rochester, that were chartered to take those employees to the picnic for a day of relaxation and festivities. And in some cases, entire families made their way on board the Eastland in anticipation of this great celebration. However, the Eastland had serious design flaws when it was built in 1902, one problem being it was very top-heavy. There were two incidences shortly after the ship launched that involved a serious list or a lean to one side, and the ship was also damaged when it backed into a tugboat in 1903. In addition, after the Titanic sank in 1912, new rules placed lifeboats and preservers on top of the deck, making this already unstable ship even more treacherous. Shortly after 7 a.m., the ship was filled to capacity with 2,752 people aboard, many of them on that upper deck of the boat, standing on the port side, which was away from the dock side, to get a view of the river. Due to the weight imbalance, the ship began to list towards the water, to which the crew opened the ballast tank so they could fill with water and put the ship back on a center line. It didn't work. At 7:28 a.m., the ship suddenly lurched sharply away from the dock and rolled fully on its port side and began to sink rapidly into dirty and murky water. Those who were on the top decks were tossed into the river. Those who had moved below were trapped inside. And as the ship came to a rest on the bottom, only 20 feet below the surface, those below decks were crushed by the sheer weight of the water, along with heavy furniture, pianos, bookcases, and trunks. In spite of the quick response by the Kenosha, which was close by in the river, a total of 844 passengers and four crew members died in that tragedy on the Eastland. In just 15 minutes, 22 families were wiped out. The river filled with bodies of infants and children, teenagers and the elderly, and every age in between. Well-wishers and neighbors who had come to see their friends off on a holiday ended up having to use gaff hooks and ladders to pull their loved ones out of the water. Eventually, divers were used to recover dozens of corpses. Bystanders helped out, laying the bodies out so they could be transported to the various morgues in the area. And by that afternoon, the remaining unidentified bodies were taken to the armory of the 2nd Regiment on Washington Boulevard, just a few blocks from the river. The Eastland tragedy claimed more than three times the lives than in the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. So why the history lesson? Well, the armory of the 2nd Regiment on Washington Street, where that makeshift morgue was set up with the blocks of ice next to the bodies of the Eastland victims, would eventually become the Harpo Studios, home of The Oprah Winfrey Show. I began working across the street from that main studio in 2006, part of the team developing and creating Oprah and Friends for SiriusXM Radio, along with a stellar group of broadcasting professionals. I had great satisfaction in building the concept from the ground up to a viable satellite channel for about 4 years. As the senior producer of two daily programs, The Dr. Oz Show and The Gene Chatsky Show, along with Bob Green's weekly hour on health and fitness, my team kept a serious pace, but we had a pretty good time doing it. In October of 2008, we were taping with Gene Chatsky, who at the time was the financial editor of The Today Show, in Edit One, a small studio that we used mostly post-production, but was occasionally pressed into service to record shows as well. While normally her Oprah radio shows had to do with money, for fun, I thought I'd try something a little different and scheduled a Halloween show. And being the pro that Gene is, she went along with the program no problem. So, Gene was locked into an ISDN line, which is a closed-circuit dedicated line from her home outside of New York, and the guest on the phone was my old friend, the late, great Richard Crow, a.k.a. the Ghost Hunter, and a lifelong Chicago historian. Now, I had met this remarkable man at the Alexander Robinson burial grounds that I wrote about in Chapter 3 many, many years before, and we'd become good friends. And when it was time to tape a Halloween episode for Gene's show, Richard, of course, was my go-to guy. For this particular outing, we had Richard on talking with Gene about all the haunted places in Chicago, the stops he made as a guide of the supernatural tours, which included the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, the aforementioned burial ground of Alexander Robinson, searching for the ghost of Clarence Darrow by the Jackson Park Lagoon, and perhaps the most famous of them all, Resurrection Mary, who is a hitchhiking ghost that picks up rides in cars of unsuspecting gentlemen only to vanish when they get to the gates of the Resurrection Cemetery. Scary shit. Now, the main reason I wanted Richard on the show was to talk about that Eastland tragedy and the numerous sightings of the Gray Lady in the lower level of the main Harpo studio buildings, who is presumed to be one of the drowning victims whose body was brought to that makeshift morgue back in 1915. Now and then, I would hear the security guys talking about some of the odd noises and things that were purported to be heard when they were walking around the building doing security checks. Sound of music, crying, and one of them mentioned that there was actually security footage of that apparition caught on film as proof. However, none of that stuff ever happened in the building I worked in, located kitty corner across the street from the main building. Or so I thought. During this particular recording session, there were three and sometimes four of us crammed into the little edit suite. Myself, Katie, who was my board op and editor, Teresa was in there from legal, and Matt was one of our engineers who always kept the tech vigil whenever we were taping via ISDN. So Richard had done a great job sharing some of his more chilling moments with Gene, who took it all in stride. We wrapped up the show, thanked Richard for his time and dedication, let him go on the phone, and closed off that line. We were having small conversation via a talkback speaker with Gene on the closed circuit line. Katie's mixing down the audio clip. Matt and Teresa are just kind of hanging out as we're getting ready to tape another show. And that's when it happened. A distended voice fills the room.
Niels Peterson will not be forgotten.
What was that? And then it happened again. Sounds like it's coming from a small auxiliary speaker that isn't turned on or even being used in any way, shape, or form.
Niels Peterson will not be forgotten.
We all just sat there with our mouths hanging open. Even Gene heard it through the talkback line all the way in New York. What the f*** was that, I said. Katie's eyes were as big as saucers, Teresa didn't know quite what to say, and Matt, being the guy he is, scribbled down the name we all heard. The crew needed a timeout. I opened the door in the little room and let some fresh air in, and whatever the hell that was, out. Now, word of the encounter spread fast, and after another check of the wiring, with regards to recording and editing, it was determined that there was no way for a voice from any other outside source to have come through that speaker that wasn't even turned on. Eventually, we resumed taping Gene's show with the door open, and that was the end of it, for about 3 hours. Later that afternoon, Matt comes into my office and says, "You're not going to believe this." He had dug through the list of victims that died in the Eastland disaster. Peterson, Niels, real name Nelson Rasmus, 46 years old, married, Danish, buried in Oak Ridge Cemetery, foreman, Western Electric Company. Unbelievable. And yet, we all heard it from a speaker that wasn't even plugged into the audio board. I don't know how long it took for us to start using that edit suite again or how many times I turn on all the lights if I was working late at the studio, but to this day, if I bring up that visit with those of us that were there, the hair goes up on the back of my neck or on my leg. So what was that all about? I'm still not quite sure. Shortly thereafter, I started digging into the electronic voice phenomena, or EVP, concept, which are sounds found on electric recordings that are interpreted as spirit voices that have been either unintentionally recorded or intentionally requested and recorded. It was the famed parapsychologist Konstantin Raudive who popularized the idea in the 70s and described EVP as a typically brief event, usually in the length of a word or short phrase. But if that's the description, we weren't requesting the presence of Niels Peterson or anyone else for that matter. The short phrase thing fits, and as I recall, the voice was clear and concise and matter-of-fact, as if making a declaration of sorts. And the fact that multiple people heard it is unusual, as if hearing voices from a speaker that's plugged in is what, normal? Whose voice was it? What about Mr. Peterson shouldn't be forgotten? Later that week, I mustered up the courage to call Richard at his office and share what happened. He wasn't surprised, thought it was very cool, told me to let him know if it happened again. I assured him he'd be the first person I called, but once was more than enough for me. As I began to make a list of experiences I've had that would eventually become chapters in this book, including that multiple people had witnessed, were of a high priority for me. It's one thing for me to have a dream or a visit or some unexplained phenomena, but quite another for a group encounter like this one that, in my opinion, lends credibility and credence to the overall message and intent of this book. And what is that message exactly? That there's far more going on than meets the eye, and for whatever reason that I don't know, at times the veil between here and there is very thin. These experiences, while at times are unnerving, are somehow normal when it comes to the lingering life force of energy that I believe each of us carries while we're alive and apparently can still manifest after we're gone. Sometimes long gone. The former Harpo Studios is now the headquarters of that fast food chain with the Golden Arches that sells billions of burgers. I'm not sure what's across the street where our radio studios used to be. I don't get over to that part of the city much. I often wonder, however, if all that digging in the ground at the site that one time held all those bodies of so many that tragically died in the Eastland disaster has further disturbed those who seem to be spiritually interred there, even though their bodies are buried somewhere else. I wouldn't be one bit surprised if they make their presence known in some way, shape, or form. While I was writing this chapter, it got on me big time to find this Oak Ridge Cemetery. I mean, never heard of it, but I'm writing this chapter thinking, maybe I should know where it's at. As fate would have it, it's right next door to me, literally a 10-minute walk. We did a little digging, no pun intended, and found that Niels Peterson is buried in Section 12, Plot 96. As it turns out, he's buried there with his little 4-year-old son, Royal, who also drowned that day with his father. His wife, Viola, survived the horror of the Eastland, buried her husband and boy, and after a second marriage and restarting her family, died at the young age of 37 from a broken heart. At first, seeing their names on that grave marker sparked a deep sense of sadness, as I wondered if anyone had ever visited their resting place in the past century. And then came a feeling of mission accomplished. as the only reason I was even standing on that spot was because of a distended voice on a radio speaker over a decade ago.
Niels Peterson will not be forgotten.
Over time, their stone had been slowly sliding off its base, so I lifted it up and put it back to its original position. I scraped off the lichen and the dirt, cleaned out the deep grooves, worn into the marker, and oddly enough, if you view the memorial from its side, it's a book carved in stone with Niels and Royal's names etched on the pages. To that end, I now make routine visits to the resting place of this father and his son. It's right close by. I walk by there quite often. It gives me a chance to take a few minutes to think about that July day 105 years ago when there was no way that Niels and Little Royal could have known that it would be their last and that they would be buried side by side for eternity. And if nothing else, because you're reading these words and seeing their names and hearing me talk about it on this podcast, if only for the length of this chapter and the time of this episode, then in fact, they're not forgotten. As I said before I started reading this, this is all true. The things that have happened to me that are in that book, the experiences that I've had, they're humbling and unnerving at the very same time. All of this goes back to when I was 19 and had a severe electrical shock, died basically, and was brought back to life by the pharmacist, a guy named Mike, who stayed late at the Osco drugstore I was working at. And I thought I was impervious and bulletproof back then, and I'm glad I bounced back from it. But ever since then, there's been something else going on. And you can look online at people who've had electric shocks, and things happen, and you can't explain it. And I'm supercharged on some level that I'm never comfortable with. When these things have happened to me, for the most part, I don't talk about them. But something was on me. There was a nudge, a push on me to share this stuff. And the big aha that's come out of that is the response I've gotten from people who've had experiences on their own they can't explain. And we're never comfortable about talking about them. So writing the book somehow gave them a little bit of permission to say, listen to what happened to me. So I get these emails after people read the book, and they're describing stuff that comes from another place and another time in them. And it's part of their life experience. And so what I'm getting at, I suppose, in a very broad sense here, is that you can look at the world through a keyhole, just the headlines that are going on, and say, this is a shitbox. And you'd be right. You also have the opportunity to look at life in between that stuff. Between the headlines, there's a space between the headlines and the lifelines. And in that space is where the magic is for me. It's where the most amazing things can happen. But you can't see that or experience that if all you're doing is watching the headlines and beating the shit out of each other. When I walk over to the Oak Ridge Cemetery and I see their gravesite and I look at Niels and Royal's headstone and all the ones around it, as I said, not a political delineation on any of them. Father, mother, sister, brother, auntie, uncle, beloved brother, sister, friend, veteran. That's what's scribed for eternity. And maybe that's the big lesson and takeaway for me on this, is that all those people got on that ship that morning, think it was the greatest adventure of their lives, and most of them lost their lives. And so that you never know when it's going to end. And since tomorrow's not promised to any of us, how do we live our lives today in a way that honors the fact that the odds of being born are 1 in 400 trillion, and that you showed up with no guarantee of when you're leaving? You know your birth date. Everybody has a birth certificate. Tells you when you got here, what time, what hospital. Might have a footprint on the back. My foot wouldn't fit on the paper at all anymore. I have this little tiny footprint, and I'm wearing 13s. But we know when we got here, but we don't know when we're leaving. And that not knowing of when we're leaving should be the leverage point for a life that is about building bridges, not just digging ditches. So if you want to get the book, it's easy to do. I don't really push this as much as, you know, on my own show. I do a lot of interviews on other shows, and I never want people to come here and feel like they got to buy anything, even though it's the way of the world. But if you want to pick up the book, the best place to get it is lulu.com. And that way the proceeds and the royalties go to yours truly more than it does to that other shopping place that's named after a river in South America. So lulu.com, the name of the book is Phenomenon, Sacred Moments, Messages, Memories, and Other Shit I Can't Explain. Until next time, safe travels. Be well. Adios.